Our guest today is the founder of Box of Crayons. He's the author of the best-selling book, The Coaching Habit. Recently, he added another book to his numerous bestsellers. The title, How to Begin, Start Doing Something That Matters. And he will share with us another surprise in this episode. He was a Rhodes Scholar and in 2019 was named the number one thought leader in coaching. Before founding Box of Crayons, he held senior positions in the corporate, consultancy and agency worlds. He has lived and worked in Australia, the UK, the US and Canada. He holds a Master of Philosophy from Oxford, a law degree and a Bachelor with the highest honors from the Australian National University. Very interestingly, in his author profile, we learned that as an unskilled laborer, he beat himself unconscious with a shovel. His greatest success, it also says there, was meeting and later marrying a Canadian woman who does not take him too seriously.
That's true.
For more than 5.5 years, we have been looking at how work strengthens people instead of weakening them. In more than 360 conversations, we've talked to more than 400 people about what has changed for them and what needs to change further. We are quite sure that it is important right now, because the idea of the Utopia New Work was developed during a real crisis. Why is coaching an important habit and why should leaders in particular engage in it? We're looking for methods, role models, experiences, tools and ideas that bring us closer to the core of new work. In addition, from the very beginning, we have been concerned with the question of whether all people can really find and live what they really, really want in their innermost being. You are at On the Way to New Work today with Michael Bungay-Stanier. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here. That was a wonderful introduction. And I am, you know, we're going to be agreeing violently with each other for the next hour because we are all into this idea of what new work might be. So I'm excited for the conversation.
Thank you so much. So we explained before that new work is a phrase we are using in Germany and that we all know that you would probably say the future of work, and it is so nice that you use already in your introduction our phrase. Thank you.
Yes.
Michael, we always, or not always, but in most cases, we ask our guest a first introduction question, and this time it's Christoph who will ask you.
And I was just wondering, like, is there like one episode where we don't ask that question? We actually,
yeah. Who's the one person who didn't get asked this question?
I hope we didn't miss anyone. But Michael, you get it. It's the question of questions. How did you become the person that you are today?
That's such a good question, isn't it? I have a podcast as well, and I ask people, what's your story? Which is a similarly impossible question to answer. And the phrase that I love that's connected to this is inspiration is when your past suddenly makes sense. Because, you know, it's like impossible to predict where you end up from where you were 20 years ago or 30 years ago. But when you look back from where you are now, you can kind of go, oh, that's why that thing happened and I had that terrible boss and I had that great boss and I learned that thing and I didn't learn that other thing. So if I had to pick a few key things that gave me a chance of ending up as I am now, which is somehow a successful book writer, somehow started a business or two, somehow living in Canada. All of that would have felt impossible to my 20-year-old self. But the first thing to know about me is I was born in Australia, but I was born to a British father. My dad, who grew up in Oxford, worked there for a while and then moved to Australia for a three-year contract, but met my mum and fell in love and then lived in Australia the rest of his life. Well, I decided at an early age, without knowing what this meant, that I wanted to go to Oxford University because my dad went to Oxford University and he was a big figure in my life, an important role model. And so as a 14-year-old, I was asked by one of my teachers, Michael, what are you planning on doing when you finish high school? To which I'd given no thought whatsoever, but I just kind of blurted out, I think I want to go to Oxford University, which I surprised, pretty much surprised him. But he said, well, to do that, you'll have to be a Rhodes Scholar. And I'm like, okay, I'm not sure what a Rhodes Scholar is, but I kind of made a note of it and kind of set an intention at 14 to try and become a Rhodes Scholar. And that was actually very helpful because in some ways I started going, how do I start building up a story that might give me a chance of being a Rhodes Scholar? So that's the first important thing. The second important thing is to know that when I got to university, I did in fact apply to become a Rhodes Scholar. And I was excited about it. I went and asked, you know, how does this work? And the woman behind the desk said, look, you send in your application and then everybody gets a first interview. And then we shorten their first interview down to a short list. And then the short list has interviews and then we pick a Rhodes Scholar. And I'm like, great. I sent in my application. I didn't even get a first interview. I was like, man, how bad was my application? Oh, I know. She said everybody got a first interview except for me, apparently. Yeah. So the key thing was that 2 years later, I reapplied. You know, I could have gone two ways there. I could have gone, well, that dream is dead. I'll carry on and find out another path. But I held on to it. And 2 years later, I reapplied. And through a combination of good luck and good timing, got selected to be a Rhodes Scholar. So that was a really significant incident as well. I think the third thing that I would name as being really crucial was when I finally finished my master's degree at Oxford. And I've now been in university for 6 years or 7 years, so a relentlessly long time. I really did. I was offered the chance to do a PhD at Oxford, and I'm like, I'm not that smart. I don't want to do a PhD. But I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I cast around and I applied for jobs and got rejected by most of them. But I ended up getting a job in what you would call now a new product development company. So companies that come up with new products and new services when companies are looking to launch new stuff onto the market. So we'd be called up by, you know, a soup maker, like, we need new soups for next year, go away and invent new soups. And inventing new soups involved two key things. One is it involved talking to people, running focus groups. You'd sit down with people who love soup and you'd go, why do you love soup? What soup do you really love? What disappoints you about soup these days? You know, and the other thing we'd do is we would generate ideas about what new types of soup might be, and we'd try ideas out like that. And that consumer research and focus groups built on something else that I'd been doing for a while, which was crisis telephone counseling at my university. So on kind of youth suicide hotlines and stuff like that. And I think that's where there was a deepening in my bones of what it means to ask a powerful question and then be quiet and listen to it. And it was also a company that instilled in me the joy of zigging when other people are zagging, trying to be different. You know, you see that in me naming my training company Box of Crayons. It's a name that you're either going to go, that's interesting, or you're going to hate. And working in that first company helped with that. And then if I had to name a final moment, I'm now living in the States in Boston, and I noticed that there was this thing called coaching beginning. This is in the 90s. And, you know, I was looking at it, it's like it's mostly in California. And, you know, I'd lived in England long enough that we just assumed that everybody in California was slightly nuts, you know, kind of touchy-feely, woo-woo people. I was like, you know, there's something interesting in this whole coaching idea. And that's when I first started talking about myself as a coach. And I ended up moving to Toronto in 2001, trained as a coach. Built a coaching practice, realized to my deep surprise that I didn't want to be a coach. That work wasn't fulfilling for me after all. It didn't feel like it had enough reach and enough scale. And that's where I started discovering that my real skill, probably the thing I can do most uniquely, is take ideas and unweird them and simplify them and make them practical and tangible for people. And that all of this combined to help me go, This is why I'm going to write a book called The Coaching Habit, which is trying to unweird coaching. So people who aren't coaches, who aren't into coaching, think to themselves, oh, if this is coaching, I could probably do that.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Let us stick to this book and to this idea. I will just give you some context. We had a behavioral scientist on our podcast, Therese Houston. She wrote a book, Make Feedback Your Superpower.
Oh, nice.
And she's describing three ways of feedback. And she's the first feedback is appreciation. When someone is doing something good,
yeah,
appreciation. If you want to evaluate someone on a regular basis, give him an evaluation and tell him where stands he and what the future could bring. And in every other case where you want to give feedback because someone is getting in trouble or is not in a good position or does something wrong, she said, it's coaching,
yeah,
for a leader. It was the first time when I heard this, that coaching as a leader is something which is serious. And what she then said is, whenever you give feedback, you as the one who gives feedback, you have to listen more than you talk, which was nice. New for me. And when I read your books, I said, wow, now everything makes sense. Yeah,
that's right. It's one of the reasons why feedback, I mean, there are two reasons why feedback go wrong. The first is when somebody says, can you give me feedback, or I'm going to give you feedback, we're not quite clear whether it's appreciation, evaluation, or coaching. So mm-hmm. if I go, hey, Michael, can you give me feedback? And mm-hmm. I'm really wanting basically appreciation. I just want mm-hmm. you to say, Michael, you are one of our best guests. We love mm-hmm. you. Mm-hmm. And you go, well, Michael, so far you're about 4 out of 10 as a guest. I hate this man. I hate this experience.
Yeah.
So you're kind of out of sync like that.
Yeah.
But I do think that even when you give feedback that is appreciation or evaluation, it becomes richer when you then ask coach-like questions around it. So if I said, you know, if you said, Michael, how am I doing as the host of the show? Can you give me some evaluation? I'm like, sure. Look, here's what I really think you're doing well. I love the pink sign and I love the studio and I love that you're both in a very Germanic way wearing black turtleneck skivvy things because, you know, that's you're living a cliche for me there, right there. So it's perfect. But, you know, I'm not sure about your partner. I think he's dragging you down or something like that. Then yeah. I go, and then I can ask, so how does that land? What seems true? What seems useful about that?
Mm.
What of all of that, what do you choose to act on? What doesn't feel true for you? Now I'm asking you questions to really make the feedback come to life, because otherwise it just lands like a cold lump of something, stroganoff, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Whereas the coaching is what actually makes it into a conversation between two people and helps you extract what's useful whilst also strengthening the relationship at the same time.
Can you remember the point in the past when this past that you were looking on suddenly yeah. makes sense and inspired you to the book?
Well, The Coaching Habit was actually my fourth book. It's the first mm-hmm. one that's been a really big, big success. Probably the only one that will ever be a success to the extent that that one has. But I had one of my grandparents, Maida, my dad's mum, was a writer. And so there'd been something role modeled to me mm-hmm. around you can be a writer. And I'd written small things most of my life. You know, through university, I wrote in the university newspapers and magazines. And when I got a job, I'd always start a newsletter for the office I was in. When I started my company 20 years ago, I started writing a newsletter. So I've been writing hundreds of newsletters over the time. So I knew that writing was one of my better ways of trying to figure out what I wanted to say and to find a voice that felt unique and different and helpful. I had an idea for a book. This is back in 2005. And I was playing around with it and I couldn't quite make it work. And I put it away in a drawer. And then my cousin, 2 years later, called me up and said, hey, Michael, I remember you telling me about that book and it's clear that you're not writing it. Is it okay if my boss and I write it? Because we think it's a really good idea.
You're kidding me.
So I was like,
how about
no, that's not okay. So I found the book and I kind of dusted it off and I created it and I self-published it. And that kind of started this book writing moment. And I feel that one of the things I'm good at is this idea of taking what's complicated or abstract or theoretical and making it simpler and more practical and more usable. And so I'd done that a few times with other books. I wrote a book called Do More Great Work, which is about how do you find the work that has more impact and more meaning in your life, you know, very much about what new work is. I just remember hitting this moment where I'm like, I've got a new book to write and it's about unweirding coaching, making coaching an accessible tool for the everyday manager and leader and individual contributor, because it's such a powerful technology of leadership and it's so underused because it's got such bad branding. It comes with so much baggage.
Yeah.
And I went back to the New York publisher, actually, and I'm like, I've got a great idea for a book. And they're like, okay, we published one of your books. Why don't you go and write it? So I wrote it, showed it to them. They went, no, we don't like it. I was like, oh, okay, well, that happened. So I went away and wrote a second version of it and took it to them, and I went, ta-da. And they went, no. I was like, okay. I did this 6 times.
Yeah, wow.
And finally on the 7th time, I was like, okay, I'm really clear what this book is now. I've written bad versions. I've written kind of half good versions. I kind of lost my confidence about the idea, but I came back to it and kind of figured out this is the idea I've got. And I went to them and I went, this is it. It's yes or no. It's not go back and have another go. It's like you either commit to it now or we say no and we stop this farce and charade. I was so confident that they were going to say yes because, you know, my previous book had sold 100,000 copies with them, which is a lot.
Which is very like, cool.
Yeah, exactly. But they turned me down. I was shocked. But it was actually one of those other kind of crossroads moment that you asked me at right at the start, because, again, it's like applying for the Rhodes Scholarship. It was this moment where I could walk away from this or I could bet on myself. And I bet on myself. I self-published The Coaching Habit.
You self-published it in the beginning?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So, in fact, it's still self-published.
Wow.
So I... my commitment, though, when I was self-publishing it, was I wanted to self-publish this as a professional. So I hired an editor, hired a designer, hired a copy editor, and actually got introduced to the company that still creates my books. They're called Page Two. They're based in Vancouver. And so this is really called the hybrid publishing model. So I'm the executive editor. I put up the money to fund the creating of this book. But they make sure that a beautiful book gets created and gets distributed around the world.
Und hier kommt die Werbung. Gleich geht's weiter mit On the Way to New Work. Bleibt dran, unser Werbepartner diese Woche ist niemand Geringeres als Sage. Für Sage durfte ich auch schon mal auf der Bühne stehen. Ein spannendes Unternehmen, solltet ihr euch eh mal anschauen. Aber hier geht's um eine wirklich spannende Studie, die Sage rausgebracht hat, nämlich die HR-Trends, also quasi die Zukunft des Personalwesens, der Personalarbeit, also alles, was man für HR in Zukunft wissen sollte. Und hier geht's um tiefgehende Einblicke in die aktuellen und zukünftigen Herausforderungen eben im HR. Beispielsweise aus der Studie hier mal ein kleiner Fakt, den ich sehr spannend fand. 78% der HR-Führungskräfte glauben, dass der Einsatz von künstlicher Intelligenz bei den HR-Aufgaben in Zukunft viel Zeit einsparen könnte. Oder 79% sind überzeugt davon, dass HR-Prozesse in ihrem Unternehmen stärker automatisiert werden können, um die Effizienz zu steigern. Ich finde es deswegen spannend, weil ich auch schon Anfang des Jahres gesagt habe, das wird das Jahr der Automatisierung und KI ist dazu wichtig. Und wenn ihr da weiter einsteigen wollt in das Thema, dann solltet ihr euch unbedingt die Studie runterladen. Das Ganze findet ihr kostenlos auf Sage, geschrieben S-A-G-E, also www.sage.de/HR, S-A-G-E geschrieben. Und was muss man noch wissen? Sage hat sich zur Aufgabe gemacht, KMUs bei der Bewältigung ihrer HR-spezifischen Herausforderungen durch innovative Softwarelösungen zu unterstützen. Das heißt, diese Lösungen helfen euch dabei, Geschäftsprozesse zu vereinfachen, zu automatisieren, was eben eine viel effizientere und effektive Personalverwaltung ermöglicht. Damit habt ihr dann mehr Zeit für die wirklich wichtigen Themen, anstatt einfach nur Prozesse zu managen. Also, schaut euch das Ganze an. Hier geht es aber erstmal um HR-Trends, die Studie auf www.sage.de/hr. Und jetzt wünsche ich euch viel Spaß mit dem Rest der Folge von On the Way to New Work.
Cool.
This is a whole new work story in itself. That's
yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. So when I read that you had several approaches for this book, I felt very connected because we launched a book a year ago.
We had
called,
one
approach. Like our podcast, On the Way to New Work. And
yeah, beautiful.
And we had three approaches as well. We destroyed the first version on our own because we didn't like it, and the second version as well. And then with the third version, it was we did not sell 100,000. We had 10,000 now, but for Germany, it's quite good, and it helps us to
it, look. It's quite good anywhere in the world. Yeah. I'll tell you the numbers for how books sell. It should put anybody off ever wanting to write a book.
Hmm.
So this is what they call the front list. So books that are published by regular publishers in their first year. And these are books that publishers have paid money for. In the first year, 15% of books sell less than 10 copies.
10.
I know. You're like, surely you have 10 family members who would buy the book for you. Surely you would buy 10 copies of your own book. But no, apparently not.
Yeah.
84% of books sell less than 5,000 copies. Mm. And 5,000 copies is considered the break-even number for most publishers.
Yeah.
84% of books don't break even. And 0.4% of books sell more than 100,000 copies in the first year.
Mm.
So selling 10,000 copies of a book is a big achievement. I mean, you know, the fact that The Coaching Habit sold 1.2 million copies is a huge number that distorts reality.
Yeah.
And, you know, I honestly think that getting 10,000 copies of your book out into the world, that's 10,000 people. That's a stadium of people who bought your book. That's
Thank
amazing.
You. Yeah, cool. Let's come back to your book, and because we want to talk about the other books as well, let's just have a closer look to the idea of simplifying coaching. So your idea was then to reduce coaching to the most powerful questions that there are. Is it right? Is this the core idea?
I would frame it slightly differently, but mostly agreeing with what you're saying. I think we're reducing coaching to a single act of behavior. The single act of behavior is to stay curious a little bit longer.
Hmm.
Simple to say, difficult to do.
Hmm.
You know, when I get going on it, I say, can you stay curious a little bit longer? Can you rush to action and advice giving a little bit more slowly? Because we rush to action and we love to give advice, and it is our default response. The seven questions that I talk about in the Coaching Habit book, which I think are seven questions that will serve most conversations most of the time, are the tools by which you get to stay curious a little bit longer.
Wow. Thank you. That is an elevator pitch.
Yeah. And I love about it is, as you pitched before, that it makes a complex thing a simple idea that you say, okay, I buy that and I can do that.
Yeah.
It gives you the feeling, I can really do that. And I know from our group, I'm part of Entrepreneurs Organization, Michael, as well.
Yeah.
They, of course, use the book for coaching. And I can, like, when I read the questions, I'm like, okay, I heard that before in a coaching session.
That's great.
The interesting thing is, once you have something that you can use how do I stay more curious? Okay, here's a question.
Yeah.
What I would be interested in, what about the situations when emotion take you out of the path of having a clear mind? You're involved in a conversation, you get more emotional, you know, okay, I really, really want to stay a bit more curious longer, but it triggers me something. Like,
of course, it will happen to everybody. It happens to me. It's like, so that's in part why this is called the coaching habit.
Mm-hmm.
Because what a habit is an unconscious reflex. And the more you can practice enough so that something becomes a habit, the more likely you are that your first response is going to be one of curiosity rather than being triggered into emotion or reaction or advice or suggestions or whatever it might be. So But first of all, of course you can't, you will not do this flawlessly. Of course there'll be moments where you're like, oh, I should have just asked a question rather than given advice. You're looking to trend towards staying curious longer. So my suggestion is not to just make a declaration that you're going to be more coach-like, curious longer, you know, with everybody all the time, but you get much more specific. You know, if you're going to start, there are 7 questions, pick one of them or pick 2 of them and you go, these are the ones I'm really going to try and build some muscle on, do some reps on, trying to get these into my bones a little bit. And then don't just say, I'm going to ask, you know, what's on your mind or what's the real challenge here for you, but pick a moment so that you can say, this is where I'm building this habit. There's that wonderful quote, which I'm not quite sure where it comes from. I think it could be a Stoic philosopher, Heraclitus. It could be the American army. But it's like you don't rise to the challenge. You fall to the level of your training or you fall to the level of your preparation. So, you know, if I'm like, okay, I'm going to build a coaching habit with Christoph. This is what it sounds like. And this is the first chapter of the book and the new habit formula. It's like when this happens, instead of I will. When this happens, the context, the moment, instead of the old reaction, I will, the new habit. So it goes like this. When I have my one-to-one weekly meeting with Christoph and he starts complaining about Michael, as he always does, so that's the context. Instead of me leaping in, trying to fix it and solve it and saying, you know what, I'll go and talk to Michael and I can see if you can get your podcast back on track, I'm going to ask the question, Christoph, what's the real challenge here for you? So I know that in the past, every time Christoph starts complaining about Michael in my one-to-one meetings with him, that kind of triggers me and I try and save the day or provide the solution or whatever it might be. Now I'm setting myself up to go, I'm trying to learn a new skill, I'm trying to learn a new habit. So I would say, you know, be kind to yourself. Of course, there's going to be moments where you don't ask the question and you wish that you did. But even recognizing that you missed the moment and you missed an opportunity is a great success because awareness is actually the foundation for building a new habit.
I was just wondering how he knows about our
It's obvious.
Issues.
I'm just watching you too, and I'm like, yeah. I mean, look at the big gap in the sofa between the two of you. I
Michael,
mean, like,
that's because your book is in between, and this book is so powerful, it pushes us apart.
The book is the only thing holding the two of you together. If the book wasn't there, you'd be sitting in chairs on either side of the sofa.
Let me add another question to that, because I was just drawn into this conversation. You asking a question, Christoph, what's the real challenge here?
Yeah.
Let's assume there is someone sitting on the other side who is then emotional, like, let's say it's family member, whatever, and saying like, now you're starting your coaching bullshit again or something like that. What do you do then?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what I think, but how would you respond to that?
I remember situations when I'm sitting there and I'm usually kind of stunned because I say like, when I ask a question like that, in most of the cases, I'm truly curious to know. So I'm surprised in that moment to say like, okay, let's have a beer or something. So I switch to something else when I'm like run over.
Yeah. You know, I've got two principles that I operate in general, and they might apply in a moment like this. The first is always agree. A friend of mine called Mark Bowden, he has a company called Truth Plane, Plane, and he calls it the yes state, which is like whatever somebody shows up with, You always nod and you always go, okay, maybe, sure, okay, perhaps. Because as soon as you go, no, I'm not, now you've set the conflict. Now it's me versus you. Now one of us is trying to prove that they're right. Somebody's going to win, somebody's going to lose. So I have the yes state, which is, you know, if you know anything about theater, it's like it's an improv state of mind, which is like you always say yes and to whatever gets offered up. So the yes state, and then I'm going to stay curious longer. Those are the two principles of which I'm trying to offer.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm like, okay, Christoph, you know, what's hard about this for you? And Christoph goes, see you and your coaching bullshit, Michael. I hate it when you coach me. I'm like, I go, oh yeah, I know. It sounds like I'm trying to coach you. And I'm sorry if that's winding you up, but I'm just genuinely curious, you know, really what's hard about this for you? If I can understand that, that can help me figure out what's going on here. So I'm using exactly what you actually said to me, which was, I'm just genuinely curious.
Yeah. Love it.
Because there's something about people hate being put through a process. You're putting me through the coach meat grinder. Oh yeah, you're just going to run through some questions. You don't even care. People love being heard and seen. And so there's a way of rather than hardening in that moment, softening of going, look, I'm genuinely committed to trying to figure out what's going on here. I'm genuinely trying to be present with you. And often it doesn't always work, but because if somebody's like, I'm determined to hate you and I'm determined to kind of make sure this conversation doesn't work, it doesn't work. But I'm responsible for my side of the table.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a phrase somebody taught me. My friend, my coach, Jill Murphy, taught me that. You're responsible for your side of the table. They're responsible for their side of the table. So I can't control their anger, their frustration, what they've made up about me. But I can control me being open and curious and saying yes and do my very best to try and have a conversation that works.
Amazing. You're using a phrase which is the advice trap. When I first read this, I immediately was shocked by myself and said, well, that's what you did the last 30 years as a manager or leader.
Yeah.
You gave advice. And this was an aha moment. So when did you come up with this phrase and why do you believe, sorry, just one question. Why do you believe that advice trap really is the big big trap?
Well, you know, the coaching habit was this runaway and very unexpected success. And in the 2 or 3 years that followed its publication, I'd often get emails, and they'd be one of three different types. One is, this is fantastic. This is really helpful. I'm really enjoying the book. I'm finding it useful. I'm doing it with my team or my boss or my kids or my soccer team, whatever it might be. I'm like, amazing. I get the occasional email or review on Amazon, which is like, your book sucks and you suck. You know, my favorite review on Amazon of The Coaching Habit is, this is the worst book ever written. I mean, I've written worse books, so I know there's at least some books that are worse than that, but Sonny Davis thought that this is the worst book ever written. So I'm like, that's fine. So there's some people like that who just hate it, and that's fine. You know, you can't make everybody happy. But there was a group in the middle who would write and say, I really like this in theory. I get the 7 questions. I get the power of staying curious. I can't do it in practice. I just can't figure out how to shift my behavior. In The Coaching Habit, I introduced this idea of the advice monster, this thing that kind of comes up out of the dark and kind of takes you over you, and so that you end up giving advice and ideas and solutions when one part of you is like, stay curious longer. But 4 years after The Coaching Habit, I published a book called The Advice Trap. And it was meant to be a deeper dive into why is it hard to stay curious? Because it sounds easy. It sounds like it's a straightforward thing. But the truth is, for lots of us, we lose it. We can't shift our behavior. And it was meant to be a deeper dive into, so what keeps us giving advice even when we know we don't want to give advice? And I came up with this idea of these three advice monsters. There's tell it, save it, and control it. And they're metaphors or manifestations for really three ego states that we're trying to protect and that have served us in the past. Tell it is all about, I've got to have all the answers, because having all the answers is valuable, even though it's impossible to have all the answers. Save it is, I've got to rescue everybody. I've got to make sure everybody's safe all the time, even though that's also impossible. And tell it, save it, control it is all about, I've got to control the future. I've got to protect everybody. I've got to make sure nothing unexpected happens. Also impossible. All three of those behaviors have been helpful at some time in the past, but when they become your default behavior, they become a default way for you to stay in control, maintain high status, not give up control. And the truth is, when you, and I really think this is in some ways an essential part of what new work might be, is it is a reorientation around how power and control work in our organizations. Because we have all inherited, you know, from the Industrial Revolution, this kind of pyramid of control and power. And when you're telling somebody what to do, when you're giving them advice, it is you have high status and they have low status. You are in control, they are being told what to do. You have authority, they don't. When you ask a question, you shift how power works. You are, you know, literally empowering them. And we talk about empowerment all the time as a good thing, but we rarely discuss that empowerment often means giving up some of your control and your power and your sense of, you know, clarity and certainty. When you ask a question, you're giving control of the conversation to the other person and their answer. You're stepping into a moment of ambiguity. Was that a good question? Did it work? Can they come up with an answer? So it's a deeper shift than just can you learn seven questions?
That's the best. That's the best, really. Sorry, I have to interrupt you, but this is the best reasoning for the power of questions I've ever heard. Thank you so much. This is really a gift for me. Thank you.
My pleasure. It's the deeper agenda of the coaching habit, which is to shift power and decenter power in organizations and have people assume the power and responsibility that's theirs to have in their organizations.
It seems to me these days that people, since this, for some people, this it feels uncertain or more uncertain because, as you said, they cannot control it. So there is kind of a trend to like using power, even if it's a power that was given to you for a certain period of time, that what we see publicly, even in some countries happening, is that people go back to this old command and control. And I'm just thinking, let's stay with companies. I'm just thinking of you have a difference between you're as a leader in charge of leading people or you have someone sitting in the back being the owner, or you are both at the same time, which gives you power over the people, and you could react and they couldn't. So there is a layer underneath that is really hard to make sure that people don't have the feeling between us, oh, they could do whatever they want if they want. Like, how will we tackle that? Because the new work idea is like pitching a whole new concept of course, a shared ownership and all that stuff. But that's for the reality, often too complicated.
Yeah.
So how do we tackle this layer in between?
That's an outstanding question. and it has no clear answer, I would say. You know, I suspect you've come across the work of Aaron Dignan.
Yes, wrote a book had him
Brave,
on the show.
Yeah, Brave New Work. So his book is perfectly aligned with the new work that the two of you champion. And his podcast is called, I think, Brave New Work as well. And it's a great podcast to have on. And, you know, Aaron talks about creating organizations that have humanity at their center and also complexity at their center. So humanity is recognizing that most organizations have a default to try and strip away humanity because it's much more efficient if we just think about org charts and structures and roles rather than the messy humanity and people that are part of it. And complexity is recognizing that it's so hard to control most of this stuff. And, you know, whatever you do starts, has, you know, emergent qualities and, you know, goes off in areas and has unintended consequences. And how do you manage that when you can't actually control it? So it's very hard. You know, I don't have an answer to it. But I have a hypothesis that it happens in nodes rather than it happens in organizations. Mm. So there's a quote by a guy called Alvin Toffler, "The future's here, it's just unevenly distributed." And I think new work is here, it's just unevenly distributed. And there are... You know, the metaphor is that of the monarch butterfly. So you know this experience of, you know, the caterpillar eats a lot, like a vast amount of stuff, and then at a certain point weaves itself a chrysalis, a cocoon. And, you know, as a kid, I thought, you know, that what happened in that cocoon is the – I'm not sure exactly, you know, the caterpillar kind of unzipped its caterpillar outfit, took it off, put on the butterfly outfit, and then it was ready to go. But it's not like that at all. What happens is that in the cocoon, it just dissolves. It becomes goo. But there's something in the cocoon called imaginal cells, which have the blueprint for the future butterfly. And the imaginal cells build the butterfly from the goo of the former caterpillar. And, you know, it's like a miracle of transformation. And I suspect new work exists as imaginal cells in the goo of capitalism at the moment. And how that then starts to change the way that we work, I don't really understand, but it feels like if you can be committed to creating imaginal selves, and I suspect conversations like this or with Aaron Dignan or whoever else is part of the way that, you know, these are all contributions to imaginal selves that are holding the DNA for future ways of working.
This is a beautiful, beautiful picture of what new work is, and it even helps people to be okay with it, to have a feeling for it, because managers always want to say, okay, show me results. No, sometimes it's just a feeling that these cells that you were talking about, they are there.
Yeah.
That's great.
Wow. I could see 10 or 15 episodes together with you, but we now, until now, we just have this one episode. So I try to make the impossible, to make a step now from your first book to How to Begin, Start Doing Something That Matters. Because in the core of the new work idea, which was formulated by a philosopher called Friedrich Bergmann, a German guy who was a professor for philosophy in Ann Arbor, he created this new work movement in the end of the 80s during an automotive crisis at General Motors. And he had one key question. What do you really, really want? He was always asking. He was always using really, really to ask people, what do you really, really want? And
such a hard,
I think, how to begin, start doing something that matters sounds somehow like the answer to this question, or the recipe to find the answer.
It might be. You know, I wrote this book for a slightly different audience than I wrote The Coaching Habit for, and the new book as well. The Coaching Habit and The Advice Trap are written for the manager or the leader. She wants to create meaning. She wants to elevate her team. She wants her team to have more impact and find more meaning. And I can give them tools to help with that. How to Begin is written a little bit more for individuals going, what makes a good life for me? How do I live a life where I feel that there's meaning in it? when I come to those crossroads, because we have crossroads all the time in our lives, you know, I think maybe three main ones. One in your 20s, when you're leaving university and you're like, what does it mean to be an adult? Who am I planning on being? One in your mid-30s, when you've spent 10 years being an adult and you're like, how did I end up here? This is my plan. I executed the plan. I'm not sure I'm that happy about, you know, exactly what my life is like. And then one in your kind of, I think, 50s or early 60s, when you're, maybe your kids have left home, you're empty nester, or you're, the arc of your first career or your main career is coming to an end and you're going, I've got 20 good years left. Now what? And it's about helping find the thing that you really, really want. Which is like, what's the big thing, your next big thing? And, you know, the element of what we call a worthy goal in that book is it thrilling, important, and daunting? Thrilling, does it speak to you? Does it light you up? Does it get you excited? Does it make you actually rub your hands? That's helpful because sometimes we inherit things that we feel we should want, whereas we don't really. Important means, is this contributing to the world? Does this give more to the world than it takes? Because it's not just enough for you to be fulfilled. It's like, how do we make this world a bit better? And then the third element is daunting, which is like, is this going to help you continue to learn and grow? Because we unlock our greatness by working on the hard things. So how do you choose something that is hard that will unlock the next best version of who you are?
Is this idea inspired by Ikigai, the Japanese concept, a little bit?
It wasn't. I was trying to write another book around, a better book around individual behavior change, because I didn't feel I'd quite found a really good way to crack it. And I showed a friend the first draft of this book and he said, Michael, this is a terrible first draft. I don't even know what it's about. And when I picked through the rubble of that manuscript, it was actually that phrase, we unlock our greatness by working on the hard things, that felt like it was, I could use it. I could build with that. And, you know, I've read about Ikigai, so I'm sure it did contribute in the overall stuff I had in my head, but it wasn't a direct inspiration from that.
Bevor es mit der aktuellen Folge weitergeht, ganz kurz noch eine Botschaft in eigener Sache. Svantje Almers, unsere Co-Autorin, meine Co-Founderin von New Work Master Skills und ich starten im November unser fünftes New Work Master Skills Executive Programm zusammen mit 15 anderen Menschen, die euch Dinge vermitteln, und mit 20 bis 25 Teilnehmenden begeben wir uns dann zum fünften Mal auf die Reise. New Work Master Skills, das ist ein Programm, was euch helfen soll, über Selbstreflexion, Sinnfindung, Selbstmanagement und viele andere Fragen, auch das Thema Resilienz, Gesundheit, vielleicht einen neuen Startpunkt für euch selber zu finden, euch nochmal neu zu justieren. Dann geht es um die Stärkung des Wirs. Wie geht heute eigentlich gute Kommunikation in Teams? Wie präsentiere ich gut? Wie führt man heute? Wie organisiert man Unternehmen und auch Abläufe? Wir sprechen auch über die großen gesellschaftlichen Herausforderungen, Diversity, Nachhaltigkeit, Technologie. Und zwischen den vier Modulen, die in Hamburg stattfinden, gibt es alle 2 bis 3 Wochen Zoom-Calls, zum Teil mit den ersten Jahrgängen vernetzt. Also das sind dann offene Calls. Neben der Arbeit, die wir mit euch machen, ist das Peer-to-Peer-Coaching ein ganz, ganz wesentlicher Aspekt. Und es entsteht gerade schon so etwas wie eine ehemalige Organisation der Absolventinnen und Absolventen, wo wir natürlich eine Rolle spielen, aber nicht die wichtigste, denn die wichtigste Rolle spielen die Teilnehmenden, die das selbst organisieren. Wir freuen uns, wenn ihr euch meldet. Schaut auf der Seite newworkmasterskills.com. Da gibt es einen Reiter Executive-Programm. Ganz runterscrollen, da stehen alle Informationen, auch was kostet das Ganze, unten bei den häufig gestellten Fragen. Und wer dann noch mehr wissen möchte und vielleicht mit uns in den Dialog möchte, schickt uns eine Mail unter hello@newworkmasterskills.com. Und dann können wir gemeinsam herausfinden, ob das Programm etwas für euch ist. Und weiter geht es mit dem wunderbaren Michael.
Yeah, your three words do sound much more easy than Ikigai. So I think I saw many people failing by trying to find the Ikigai because it's so complicated to find this sweet spot. So
yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
You were talking about spoiling something before we were starting the podcast, and I was then spoiling it as well, that something's coming up. We need to talk about it because I was looking on the watch and I was like, oh my God, what happened? An hour passed by.
We are so
like,
I've been talking too much. I'm sorry.
No. Yeah, but you're working on something.
I do. I've got a new book coming out in June 2023. It's called How to Work with Almost Anyone, Building Best Possible Relationships. So this feels like the most direct build on the coaching habit work and the advice trap work. You know, it occurred to me that actually this is the better story. A couple of years ago, my dad died. And he spent the last 6 months of his life in my childhood home with my mum, and he was in a hospital bed there, and he was okay, but he had just limited movement and limited kind of mobility. And I was back home in Australia, and I was living in the house with mum and dad, and I noticed that they were kind of getting snippy, I would say, with each other. You know, they're kind of nothing, they're kind of bickering. And I really didn't, we knew dad had a terminal illness, and I really didn't want mum and dad's last 6 months to not be as good as possible. And I'd learned something from a writer who I love in this overall space around what is new work, a guy called Peter Block. And he had taught me years ago this idea of a social contract. Social contract is, can we have a conversation about how we will work together rather than what we will work on? So I, with a good deal of awkwardness, there's no way to do this without it being awkward, I facilitated a conversation between my mum and my dad about how do they want to be with each other over the remaining months of my dad's life. And it was pretty amazing. I feel very proud of that. It's one of the things I'm most proud of that I've ever done, really. It helped crystallize the thought that there's a way of writing about this that could be helpful for everybody, because you know, doesn't matter what your imaginal selves have set up and what your organizational structure is, your success and your happiness depend on your working relationships. And most of the time with our working relationships, we cross our fingers and we hope that they work. And you're like, hey, I hope it doesn't suck. I hope it's not terrible. I hope it's great. But you don't know really how to make that. You just kind of go, you just roll the dice and you see how it goes. And, you know, building on the work of Peter Block and the experience of my mum and my dad, how to work with almost anyone is how do you structure a conversation about how will we work together before you get into the conversation about what are we going to work on? So in the book, we call it the Keystone Conversation. And there are five questions to say, this is the information you want to exchange with each other so that you have the best, you can build what I'm calling the best possible relationship. Because obviously, some relationships are going to be amazing. Some relationships are going to be pretty not amazing. But each one has the potential to be the best possible version of itself.
Yeah.
And I think the three elements of that is it safe? Is it as safe as it can be? Is it vital? Meaning, is it alive as it can be? And is it repairable? Because when it gets damaged or cracked or bent, how do you fix it rather than give up on it?
You touched us. I can feel it. Christoph is getting nervous. I get goosebumps. So Christoph, come on.
And I love it. A social contract. The story of your parents. I could really feel it again. The question when it comes to the title, how to work with almost everyone. Who's this almost?
Well, I mean, there's all sorts of research to say that there's a disproportionate number of, are they psychopaths, or is it a word like psychopaths, that rise to levels of senior leadership in organizations because psychopaths. I don't think it's psychopath. It's another something path.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have a great sense of the importance of humanity and human relationships. So they're great in business because they're like, we're just going to get this done. I'm just going to get that prize. I'm just going to do that thing that's required for success. So I don't think you can make it perfect or the best possible relationships with everyone. And I didn't want to overpromise.
Yeah.
But I do think that, you know, almost everybody, you can go, I think even when it's a really hard relationship, it's like, how do you make it the best possible version of whatever that relationship might be?
I love it. And I just wanted to look for that name and that guy because it even makes more curious on the book. Thank you.
So what we really can see here, so I think we're working on a 1,000 pieces puzzle since we started our podcast. And we had Amy Edmondson on our show as well.
Fantastic.
Psychological safetiness. And I really could see we got more than just one piece of puzzle with the conversation we're having with you now. And it's really a gift. And I have to say it again. Thank you so, so much for your time, for your wiseness, for your humor and kindness and everything. And
thank
we just have one last question before we leave you into... Yeah.
It's an easy one. It will help to fade out.
Yeah.
All right.
Christoph, you invented the question.
we always, as we start, how did you become the person that you are today? And we end with a question, where do you want to go?
Well, there's a quote I have on my desk over there by the poet Rilke, who... you probably read in the original German, but I read in translated English. And it's from a poem that is translated as The Man Watching. I'm not sure what the original German title is. And there's a couple of lines in that I love. And I'll probably get them slightly wrong, but here's my best memory of them. His goal is not to win, but to be deeply defeated by ever greater things. And, you know, I feel like I've won. Like I've had a life where I've won. I've written a book that lots of people have read. And I've got a company that has not failed. I think I've built training that is improving people's lives. So I've won. So, you know, I don't know where I'm heading, but I do know that my strategy is... when there's a moment and the moment's right, I stop and I go, what's my best guess at the thing that I can do that would have the most difference for me and my commitment to be somebody who makes change happen?
Thank you so much for a very deep hour with you.
I've loved it. Thank you for having me.
Erstmal wieder sammeln, ne? Mhm. Ja, nee, tatsächlich. Also in allen Folgen normal kommt immer ein Wort aus dir raus. Das war das erste Mal, dass du hier einfach gesessen hast und dann kam gar nichts mehr. Also das war, ich hatte ganz viele andere Fragen noch und ich fand es aber so spannend, diese Mischung aus den Zugang, die Geschichten, den Connect to New Work. Also da ist richtig, richtig viel drin. Besonders abgeholt habe ich nochmal am Ende sein Quote, das Gedicht, was er da sagte, also it's not a task, a man's task to win, it's to be defeated by ever greater challenges.
Ich kann es nicht mehr erinnern.
Irgendwie so in die Richtung.
Ja, welcher war das? Welchen im deutschen Autor hat
er zitiert? Ich muss
es nachschauen. Ja, also ich bin ja sehr, wirklich sehr geflasht seit dem ersten Kontakt. Svante hat mich an ihn rangeführt ich bin beeindruckt von der Kraft, komplexe Dinge auf den Punkt zu bringen, die er hat. Also drei Punkte hier, fünf Dinge da, kleine easy Steps, die man wirklich nachvollziehen kann, die aufeinander aufbauen und die ein komplexes Thema greifbar machen. Und er ist, glaube ich, jemand, der wirklich zur Entmystifizierung von Coaching beiträgt und allein dieses Thema Stay curious, ne? Also wenn du selber redest, erzählst du, ne? Ja, wenn du selber redest, erzählst du immer nur Zeug, was du sowieso schon kennst. Und je mehr du fragst, je neugieriger du bist, desto mehr kannst du lernen über den anderen oder die andere. Und das ist Das ist mein Main Message. Und ja, also hat sich gelohnt, um ihn zu kämpfen. Und es war vom ersten Kontakt an super, super schön mit seinem Team und ihm. Und ja, ich bin guter Dinge, dass diese Folge auch unsere Hörerinnen und Hörer erreicht hat. Und wir beide, Christoph und ich, würden uns freuen, wenn ihr uns mal wieder ein paar Beurteilungen schreibt. Auch gerade diese qualitativen Dinge mal sagen. Ne, was mögt ihr oder was mögt ihr nicht? Idealerweise, was mögt ihr, geht an die Podcast-Beurteilung, was mögt ihr nicht an uns. Aber ja, das würde uns freuen. Wir freuen uns natürlich auch über 5 Sterne. Aber ich freue mich noch mehr über die Kommentare. Und ich glaube, diese Folge hätte es verdient, einen Kommentar zu kriegen von euch.
Ganz viel Unterhaltung darunter, finde ich auch geil.
Danke.